We talked a little bit, Boyer brought up that notion of skillful, and I wanted to just revisit that for a moment in light of sex as a consumer good versus sex as a covenant good. And remember that terminology I'm borrowing from Tim Keller, and there he is. It's his fault that we're going back to this. and as a consumer good, the notion, no, not Tim Keller, it's Steve Boyer, who just entered, says, I must be skillful to be accepted. Or, you know, so to speak, keep this person. Okay? Sex as a covenant good. I want to make sure I get this. We learn together how to be skillful. And I want to make sure I get the end part. For each other. This is a significant difference. This is what I lived in my before Jesus days. Okay? And then I think that's what we're figuring out after 14 years of marriage with sex as a covenant good. But here's, you know, this is all about pressure. Whoops. There's a pressure to perform. And the relationship kind of hangs on that. As I mentioned, we talked about Downton Abbey last week as an illustration of that. They had to make sure that they fit together before they would get married. And so, but from a covenant perspective, we learn together. We start as amateurs, so to speak, and our skillfulness is really in, with respect to one another, not a general skillfulness. And this is, in a sense, a reflection of the gospel in a lot of ways. Bet you didn't think I was going to get there from there, huh? A consumer kind of mindset with regard to, a worldly mindset with regard to the gospel or with, God, with respect to God is, I must be skillful at life for God to accept me. And so, it has that idea of skillfulness produces acceptance. I must continue to be skillful to maintain acceptance.
Works-based salvation.
Yes. This is what it is. It's works. And just as it's deadly in the relationship with God, it's also deadly in any kind of relationship. Not even a sexual kind of relationship. All right? Whereas here, God accepts me and maintains me in grace so that he also then teaches me to be skillful in life for his glory. Okay? So this is about grace and glory. God's glory. Whoops. Not my glory. Okay? So, all right. That was eating away at my brain this week, so I wanted to spit that out and wrap that up, so to speak. All right.
This is all my fault.
Well, you're the one who said, "Oh, a skillful lover." So it just got my brain to thinking.
You did.
Yeah, you did. We can go back to the tape if that's not the one that got all. Well, you know.
I don't have last week. So.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm a little slow.
So hopefully it's not. Yeah. Because I did something wrong to something somewhere. All right, let's get into lesson proper, this idea of sick with love. In the Last of the Mohicans, the object of Hawkeye's affection, Korra, has been captured by one of the tribes of Native Americans, the side that was allied to the French. Okay, and in the movie version, I don't remember. I haven't read. I can't remember if I've actually read the book. But, you know, the Daniel Lewis Day version, you know, with his intensity there going on is Hakai. He lays down his weapons and he enters their camp in an effort to bring her out safely. And in the process, he receives this epic beatdown for his trouble. And sometimes love makes you do really stupid things. I guess that's where I'm going with it. Wasn't probably the best course of action to try and do this, although he succeeded in the end. But our big idea this morning is that love calls on... what? That should be an us. Love calls us on an adventure to take risks we normally wouldn't. Okay? There should be an us there. We note here that from Tom Gledhill, for true love is adventurous, and every adventure loves risk-taking, and this, in turn, requires courage to overcome fears and inhibitions. When all this is faced with realism, then glorious and unexpected joys lie at the door. And so to enjoy the covenant good of love, it requires risk. Okay? At some point, you have to say, I know this person is a sinner, and I know that I'm a sinner, and just as I'm prone to self-destruct this thing, so they are prone to self-destruct this thing, and by the grace of God, together we will try to work this thing out. Okay? There's risk that is involved in pursuing love. So, here we have heard the text is far too long for us to have up there. So I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about the city. They beat me and bruised me. They took away my veil, possibly cloak. Those watchmen of the walls, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another beloved? Oh, most beautiful among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? So, we see more evidence that this is not a story, okay, meaning a dramatic plot that goes through the Song of Songs, but rather sort of a series of love poems that without a plot. This is reminiscent of one we've already seen. We talked a bit about fantasy and dreams, and it seems like she's having another dream. that's how I'm understanding this, as a sort of another dream sequence. Is she awakened by a knock at the door, or is she sleeping lightly and dreaming is sort of the kind of the uncertainty that we have at the beginning of this text. If we look at this from a dramatic viewpoint, they already would have been married, and if they are married, why does he have to knock? Right?
Yeah.
Honey, do I often knock?
No, it startles me all the time.
My wife is easily startled. She forgets that we share the same house and indeed the same room. So, and when I show up unexpectedly, she's startled. He's not in the house. He's locked out of the house. So that's one of the reasons why I kind of go, This is not following a chronological sequence. This is not really a dramatic story that's going on. So this is one of those data points that I've got. I guess he could be like the people in Downton Abbey and have a separate bedchamber, but I don't think so. Okay. Maybe he forgot his key and he didn't have his app. Like, Matt, turn off security system. Okay. She locked. Oh, boy. This crowd. But he's knocking. Is this sort of like throwing rocks at her window? I never did anything like that. Are they trying to awaken love too soon because they are lovesick? So there's a lot of questions as we sort of enter into this part of the Song of Songs. Do-Good sees it as very unlikely that she would be sleeping alone in a room with access to the outside. And so he does see this as sort of post-wedding issues. The surreal nature of what follows is what's kind of gets me going in the direction of this is sort of a dream that she has, and it's not a pleasant dream as we look through it, we recognize this. But the poems are not, quote-unquote, real anyway. Okay, this is not a historic couple. Okay, this is idealized in some ways. So, I'm not thinking these are real events like we see in Jonah or we see in Job. I think these are imaginary events. One recent commentator reads the present into the past, thinking it is about the woman pleasuring herself. Not sure how he gets there, but weird things happen when you talk about the Song of Songs. So what happens is the lover cries to her, "My sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one." And last week we talked about sister in terms of that covenant language. She's of the same faith as he. But all of these sort of stress the relational intimacy as well as stressing her beauty. My love, my dove, my perfect one. And of course, I always think of Kansas, which of course, Walsh is not on that song. This was actually a John Elefante song. But there's a perfect lover running through my head. So there you go. Stop that. Thank you. Okay. All right. There is a perfect lover running through my head, as the chorus goes in that song. If you're interested, you can listen to it in their Best Of. It was one of the ones that was not on an album until it was part of the Best Of collection. So it's a good song. So now I want to listen to the song. So, but he wants her to open the door, well, to get out of bed, open the door, so he can be with her. This could be another one of these double entendres. He wants her to open herself to him. This must be the lesson where I left off numerous personal pronouns. As I see from my notes, I had to add a personal pronoun there. Opening herself to him. The door then becomes a euphemism for her genitals, and a number of people kind of take that route. So now there's that question that begins to present itself, and we'll bump up against this repeatedly. Is this passage laden with these double entendres, or are people simply sexualizing it? Even Sigmund Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Okay? So is this, you know, are people reading too much into this? Or is this really a series of double entendres? If you're looking to me for an answer, I'm not sure I have one. Okay? And in a sense, this is why I think it was Duguid at the beginning who said that sometimes we can tell more about the commentator than we can tell about the song itself. So, I'm going to be cautious. I'm not going to throw everything to the wind like some of them do. Because I'm not really sure. I mean, it sounds intriguing. It appeals to, obviously, part of me, but I'm not sure that's exactly what's happening. So, we'll work with that tentative thesis. He says that he has been out and he is wet with dew, and for some people this implies his sexual longing. She, of course, is not dressed. She has already cleaned her feet. In order to get up, it would require first putting on clothes. Not exactly sure why, since it's her beloved, and it's night, and no one else would presumably be out there. But she's talking about putting on her clothes, and since they didn't have nice hardwood floors or tile or carpet like we do, it would possibly require her getting her feet dirty and then getting back into bed, which, if you're married at least to my wife, you know, any crumbs or dirt in bed is a bad thing. So I think most people probably would agree with that. Yeah? What? I can tease you. You left me hanging last week. I'm going to remember this. I'm not going to live by grace. I'm kidding about that. And so these sort of flimsy, at least from my perspective, flimsy excuses show the opposite of burning love. What we see is sort of indifference to the needs of the beloved. Right now she's thinking of herself. She's not thinking of herself, him. And he's probably also thinking about him. So they're both thinking about themselves, I imagine. Feet. We've come across this as well in Ruth. Feet can be used as a euphemism for genitalia. And so this may be that she is actually reluctant to engage in sexual intimacy and therefore be unclean. Have we talked about that yet? I don't think so. Yeah. Why would she become unclean?
She could have had her period.
Well, no. Well,
that would be the way she'd be
in. Yes, but in this context. Bodily fluids make one unclean. Okay, so during a woman's period, she is ceremonially unclean. In other words, she is not permitted to go into the public worship. Okay? And anything that she touches or that touches her also becomes ceremonially unclean. Okay, so usually that might be one of the reasons why a husband is told not to have conjugal relations with his wife during her period. Because then he would become unclean. Okay, so then he couldn't engage in the public worship. Semen as a bodily fluid also makes one unclean. And so you have in Leviticus all of these details. If there's a nocturnal emission, the guy's got to go outside the camp, sit around for a day doing who knows what, take a bath, and then come back. And so, you're unclean for a day because of this. Similarly, as we see in Exodus 19, as they're preparing to hear from God in the giving of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, one of the things they're told to do is to not engage in any sexual activity. And I remember reading that, preaching from that text, and it seemed like the phrase emission of semen was repeated a billion times. Now, it wasn't. It was probably like three. But, when you're reading this and there are children in the room, and, it just feels weird. So, sexual activity, while not immoral, made one unclean, ceremonially unclean. And that's the idea, the key word, ceremonial. Okay, so she might be saying, I don't want to be ceremonial unclean. I don't want to have to hang around outside the camp tomorrow and have everyone wondering, why is she out here? Oh, wait, he's here too. So, then have to do, we could interrupt the plans one had. I don't know. So that is a legitimate understanding of what's going on here. His attempt to put his hand through the latch, literally a hole, obviously could have some sexual overtones as well. For instance, in Isaiah 57, 8 through 10, hand is actually used for penis. Don't know why. I know why, because the scriptures often seek to use euphemisms for these things instead of being crass. So the idea would be inserting the penis into the hole, you get it, right? Okay. So where am I? There am I. And so he thinks, in a sense, that she's teasing him, at least initially. Her response is subject to interpretation. The ESV translates innards as heart when it could refer to her lower erogenous zones. It could be that she is aroused too. She rises up to open up to him, open the door, and perhaps also symbolically open herself to him, okay, to be receptive. The source of the dripping myrrh, of course, would be unclear. It's left by him, but it seems to indicate anticipation on someone's part. But when she opens the door, he's gone. He's missing, much to her disappointment. We are unsure as to why, since he forced the issue, and she finally responded. And so there's a little sort of ambiguity, and he was quick out of there too, because it's not like it, took her 4 days to get to the door and now he's long gone. It just seems like this all happens rather quickly. And she rises, goes to the door. He's missing. And he's nowhere to be found. Okay?
So maybe it wasn't. She gets up, but he's not really there.
And so now she's wakened. Possible. I will not rule it out.
Except that she's not going to run downtown trying to find him again. I mean, that just has dream written all over it.
Or it could be one of those dreams within a dream. Have you ever had one of those dreams within a dream? No?
Sorry.
Where you're dreaming and you have that sense of waking up from a dream, but you're in another dream. Mm-hmm. You haven't lived yet, baby.
Being Inception, yeah. You're getting mind controlled.
That's right. Inception is real. Man,
mine's too strong to be controlled. So.
Mine is not. Mine is not too core. Hey, wait a minute. I'm being controlled. I am not a puppet. Okay. relationships. Are often filled with misunderstandings, manipulation, insecurity, power plays that can only result in us being frustrated emotionally and sexually. And so I found this fun little thing here. Stop the insecurity in relationship and become a woman men can adore. And how's that for a message? A guilt-inducing, legalistic sort of message. so, I just wanted the idea of the frustration. I'm not blaming women. So, please don't think I'm doing that. but this reality of there's a frustration in relationships that occurs. Particularly when you think there's an understanding, tonight we shall play, and there's no play. that night. Frustration happens. Did I tell you about our first Valentine's together? I can't remember if I told these guys.
I don't think so, but should you? It's
fine. Yeah, sure, it's fine.
Brace yourself.
No. So, you know, I had these ideas. You know, this is our, we're married, you know, we're going to eat in. And we'd gotten a cheesecake, and did we get steak? Some nice meal that I was going to help, I was going to prepare much of the meal, all this stuff, really anticipating this, right? Night of love. And I got sick. And it was the kind of sick that you want nothing to do with sex. So it wasn't quite that bad, but when we ate the food and everything, but it still was, it was not a romantic mood, shall we say. So
steak and cheesecake, you probably just going to sleep anyway.
Some men may. I will not say anything else. So there's stuff that happens in the course of life that results in misunderstandings, and so there's frustration that goes on, and that this episode really kind of brings us into that idea of frustration. He's frustrated enough that he leaves, and now she's frustrated enough that she goes looking for him. Okay, it says that her soul failed. Is it sort of a diminishment of life? It's as if, you know, she almost died here, okay? And so we have this idea of, you know, she opened, she sought, she called. Earlier, it was him who called. It was him who sought. It was him who wanted her to open. Okay, so there's a little bit of parallelism here that's going on. She pursues him. And unlike the previous experience that we had a few chapters earlier, this one ends up in trouble. She meets the guards, but the guards are less than helpful. The guards here may represent the public gaze that looks down on her. Let's get back to... This is another one of those things. If she's the queen... Okay, why would the watchman look down on her? Wouldn't they just help her? Your Majesty, let's bring you back. I mean, if she's the queen, and there was this big public wedding ceremony, they'd all recognize who she is and just bring her home, but we don't see that. So this is another one of those data points that leads me against the idea that she's married to Solomon. Okay? And besides, Solomon wouldn't be asking, would he? If you're the king, you don't necessarily ask. She is physically and possibly even sexually abused. She is hit hard enough to leave bruises, and some of her clothing is ripped off. And so instead of seeking help from the police, so to speak, she finds herself mishandled by the police. See? It's nothing new. Nothing new under the sun. There have always been corrupt police officers or night watchmen. Now, here's the part of the irony. She didn't want to get dressed to let him in. And now, in seeking him because she waited too long, she's stripped publicly. Some argue here that she is being treated as if she is a prostitute. And so we see the public judgment of a prostitute was a ritual exposure of her nakedness. As Glenn Hill notes, and we see that taking place in God's judgment upon Israel, prophetically, in Hosea and Ezekiel. Because she has played the whore, she's going to be treated like a whore and is going to be stripped naked in front of everybody. Okay, so that could be what we're seeing here. They're thinking this woman is a prostitute, and they're treating her like one and stripping her naked. Okay. Though she is defenseless and at least partially uncovered, she seems relatively unfazed and undaunted. And so again, this seems either to be idealized fiction or the recounting of a dream via song or poetry. So, the Hebrew is difficult. She's either begging the daughters of Jerusalem, who should also be in bed. Okay. This is not downtown Tucson on a Friday night around 11 o'clock, right? This is not the world that is inhabited by the Song of Songs. Everyone else is supposed to be in bed. So, again, there's that disconnect, so to speak, that indicates this might be a dream and is fictionalized. She begs the daughters of Jerusalem to help her find him, or it could mean to not tell him what has happened to her. Okay, the Hebrew is unclear enough that it could go in either of those two directions. Okay, and so either she wants help or she wants to hide it. Okay, and that's actually a fairly common thing. Unfortunately, many victims of sexual attack try to hide it from their loved ones because they're afraid that somehow the other person will think that they're tarnished and dirty and be done with them, as opposed to recognizing we're one, we're in this together, I'm there for you. So,
are there any that would take a position on that, because they seem to have a knack for knowing their own language and history and so forth?
I mean, they'll probably be split. I think they're split same way. Because usually a lot of the commentators, if there's something like that, they'll try to go back to those guys. For the ones who didn't take an allegorical interpretation of it, that's the other problem, is viewing this from an allegorical perspective. So, what's her excuse for being in this state of affairs? She says, I'm sick with love. I do irrational things. Okay? They ask, essentially, what is so special about him to endure this treatment and to make this plea, whichever plea it happens to be? And so, Kinlaw notes, love brings its joys, but those joys are seldom unalloyed for long. We are such flawed and fragile creatures, and interpersonal relationships contain such subtleties. With our joys come fears. Often they surface in our dreams, arising from some sense of failure or fear of inadequacy. Dreams are funky things. The night before last, I dreamt I visited Michael Rowe, who's the lead guitarist and singer for the 77s, at his apartment. No idea. I like the band. I never thought of going on a road trip and popping in on Michael Rowe to hang out with him, although we are Facebook friends, whatever that means. So sometimes dreams are really weird things, and they seem to be completely disconnected from anything. I put on Facebook, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, where, you know, I was like a secret agent or something in one dream. It was just sort of like very bizarre series of dreams. But oftentimes as well, as he notes, sometimes our fears, our sense of incompetency or inadequacy can reveal themselves in dreams. You know, as a pastor, I have those dreams, not anymore. I used to have them for a long time. But, you know, yeah, And I live this sometimes, where all the technology goes bad and there are hundreds of people waiting for the service to start and you can't get it started because, you know, you can't find the microphone or something's not working, and, you know, and this sense of inadequacy emerges. Maybe some of you had those dreams where you can't make it to the test. Yeah, for years after I graduated, I still had these things of, I've got one more test and I can't get there. You know, the train is pulling out of the station. Maybe this had something to do with going to BU and taking the subway for a couple of years. You know, you have a hard time getting onto the train, and then it's a long ride, and how am I going to pass the test? And of course, you know, those things of not measuring up happen to us. So this could be something like that. Any thoughts or questions before we kind of move to interpretations of this thing? Oh my, yeah. Oy, oy, oy. So we're planning on talking about Hosea soon this year. All right. Yeah, I'm not in a good place with Hosea. I'm already into 18 lessons with Hosea, and I have about at least two more to go. So we're not finishing Hosea this year unless we put the kibosh on the song. Like now. Anyway, the allegorical interpretation. She represents the redeemed church at her worst. She's lazy, she's neglecting the means of grace, and is indifferent to Jesus' gracious presence. His withdrawal is one of chastisement. This is very much seen in light of Revelation 3:20. You know, behold, I stand at the door and knock. The watchmen are seen as faithful shepherds that expose the sinner's folly that they might repent and be renewed. So the watchmen are really your pastor who's come to whack you upside the head so that you repent and run to Jesus. So that's the allegorical, or a common allegorical interpretation of this passage. The dramatic interpretation is that Solomon's job kept him away from her too much. And he was in the habit of approaching her late at night. The dream is her processing her frustration. The actions of the watchmen may represent her guilt over, quote-unquote, having a headache. So, not necessarily the most helpful of interpretations from my book. The wisdom literature, most of us lead self-focused lives which sabotage our love relationships. It is easier to break a relationship than to mend it. Oh, how true that is. Too many people would rather just start all over than practice forgiveness. This is true of our spiritual lives as well. Too often we are self-focused and disinterested in God. Then we decide to search for Him. We are conflicted and confusing people. So, which leads us to some questions, because we ain't going to finish this lesson today. What are legitimate reasons for saying not now? As we've talked about before, we can't say no, but we can say, can say not now, not tonight.
Not now.
Whatever that was, okay. You hear, I thought you were mocking me. Oh, wait, you were. Yes, not now. Not tonight. Okay. Legitimate reasons.
Health issues.
Yes, like that Valentine's Day, I was sick. Or it could be, we have some people who've had back issues here, including myself. You know, bad back or injury. So, if there's some sort of physical reason, what else might be legitimate?
Unresolved anger.
No, that's just going to the table, making your sacrifice. Right, unresolved anger. Good. W- which should mean hurry up and resolve the anger, but we don't always do that. Some of us are Sicilian and hang on to things.
Kind of going along with this one, I just think of tiredness, especially certain seasons of life, like when you've got really young children and infants, and you know, just how that kind of takes over.
As a father of four children, I understand that. Okay? So, weariness. And it could be as simple as hasn't gotten a good night's sleep in a couple of days. And you're just like, oh, I want to do a sleep. So, weariness. Any others? Surely there's more than that.
I think of, like, if you just, like, let's just say that it's somebody who's got, like, a real crisis going on at work, for example. You know, you're just really mentally anxious, perhaps, anxiety, and worried, concerned. And just really, yeah, you know, kind of just where your attention is just really on something else.
Yeah, you know, 1 Corinthians 7, you know, talking about that season of prayer, essentially, that there's something going on. It could be a parenting issue, could be a work-related, a church issue, where you're saying, right now, you know, just like we might fast from food and pray, we're going to fast from the sexual relationship and pray. Okay? That can happen. Because your heart's, in a sense, your heart's not in it. You need to pray. So.
But it doesn't actually have anything to do with your spouse.
Right. Or it could have something to do with your spouse.
But it doesn't necessarily have to.
Right. In terms of wounds from the past. People who've experienced abuse, sometimes the sexual relationship is very difficult, and so there may be a period of time where you're taking a break to pray and to apply the gospel balm to this issue that's in the heart of one person because of sin, you know, that they've been sinned against. So. Those are some things. Now, let's shift it slightly. What effect do excuses have on your spouse or on you? I'll use a different color.
Hopefully being open to kind of self-introspection to see what is making you say no will at least make the other person be aware of what's going on and can help in that aspect of the relationship.
Okay. So, if we're...
if may not know that there's unresolved anger.
Yes. If we're godly, it will increase communication. That is really a C. But sometimes... we're not as godly as we want to be, and therefore, it could decrease communication. Because of a sense of rejection. What other effects can it have?
You said it earlier.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't. You know, I wasn't blaming Amy. Obviously, I was probably blaming myself. Why did I pick now to get sick? As if I picked it. We can be irrational about these things. Okay. I don't think Amy blamed me. You know, I was probably far more, had far more built up in my head than she did, you know, in terms of expectations. So.
Well, conversely,
so.
Empathy.
Empathy? Yeah. Empathy? Yep, a good response, a positive one, is empathy. Maybe I should do these in different colors to indicate which are good and which are bad. Which can often open the door for those of you who can, service. Okay. Now again, that sort of, if there's increased communication, there can be greater empathy for what the other person is experiencing, and therefore increased service for that person. So, any others before we kind of move on here? Wow. Bitterness! You people are all kinder than I am, probably. Or you just don't want to admit the wretchedness of your heart. You know, if there's a lack of communication, you're shutting down, you can get bitter. And what happens when we get bitter is, of course, there's going to be even less going on because, you know, now we're growing in unresolved anger. And so it's a vicious circle that takes place. So we'll leave this there. Dillo notes, there is nothing more deflating to a person's ego than to have one's mate continually reject his or her sexual advances. And the key phrase word here would be continually. Okay. It's not a one-night thing, or, you know, sometimes there's a extended period of time for a health issue that can take place. But usually, if you know there's a health issue, typically you're going into it recognizing there's a possibility, a very real possibility, that tonight is not a night. And so don't take it personally. It's not about you, though we tend to make everything about us because we are, as Luther said, curved inward. So, look, 1 Corinthians 7. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because of the temptation to sexual morality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. And so part of what Paul mentions is that we lack self-control. So, there's that problem that could erupt, okay? And that Satan may tempt us as a result of our lack of self-control. So, kind of wrap this up, a typological view or Christological view is that just as sexual intimacy is not a once-for-all sort of thing, but something that is cultivated, which experiences ebbs and flows in marriage, so our relationship with Christ is one that must be cultivated and experiences ebbs and flows. Okay? Our relationship with God is dynamic, not static. It's static in the sense of it's always rooted upon justification and adoption. And so it can't stop being, but our experience of communion with Him is one that we will experience a dynamic sort of thing. We'll feel close to him sometimes, and we'll feel distant at other times. There's an ebb and a flow that takes place, and that's, you know, in the mix of, you know, am I making use of the means of grace? Am I caught in a sin right now? All of these kinds of factors. Am I experiencing hardship? So there's a number of things that go into that ebb and flow experience of communion with Christ. It mirrors the husband-wife relationship. If you're not cultivating closeness, you're not going to feel close. So there you have it. In both relationships, our reach exceeds our grasp. We want more intimacy than we seem able to obtain due to both our sin and our limitations. And so this goes into another wasif. Man, I can do this. The more I do now, the less I do later, right? She says, "My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold, set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns, sit on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." So she's responding to their question about why him. And they respond, "Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you?" And so we see that he's got good skin and complexion. He's radiant and ruddy. He's Zoolander, baby. and a warning for all of you all, Zoolander 2 is due out soon. So how have you not seen the first one? That's just... It takes a certain kind of sense of humor to appreciate Zoolander. That's all I will say. he's not just one in 1,000. He's one in 10,000. That's how special he is. And so she goes from head to toe declaring what is so great about him. We're not sure about what a head of gold is, especially since we know he has black hair. And some say this kind of points to, you know, godlike features. See, he got great hair like Zoolander, not except his is frosted a little bit there. So, it's just the whole idea of Ben Stiller as a male model is just shocking. That's part of the humor of the film. he's got great hair. It's jet black. It's wavy. His eyes, well, we go back to that whole dove thing. This one's by a pool. Perhaps the gray pupil surrounded by white. Alternative translation, his eyes are like doves by the water streams, his teeth washed in milk, set in place. So it could be talking about teeth. His cheeks, or most likely his beard, smells good and enticing. Those beards were often perfumed. And so it was great to be cheek to cheek, unless you don't like the scruffy stuff on your face. On his face, or whatever, you know what I mean. The stuff on his face, on your face. His lips are like beautiful lilies, which drip with fine-smelling myrrh. Sweet-scented herbs are often chewed as something of a mouthwash. You know, they couldn't just open up the bottle of Listerine and swish that thing down. And so they would chew on herbs to accomplish the same event, same purpose, rather. And so she kind of uses this godlike language to communicate this larger-than-life quality, which we kind of also saw earlier when he's bounding down the mountains, you know. So this is similar to that. Abdomen is smooth like polished ivory and bedecked. I guess today we would say he got six-pack abs, okay? Some think of a polished ivory tusk, and in light of that, it's possible that she would be admiring his genitals. And we have time for, hopefully a laugh. I don't know. This was on Family Feud recently. Host Steve Harvey. If you could change one part of your husband's body, what would it be? Joyce's answer, his penis. That answer, thankfully, did not make the top seven. So, would that be horrible? I mean, we think about these things of what would you want to change about the other person? And that's just a bad road to go down at all. But it points to the fact that just about everybody is insecure about something. Okay? Men have their own insecurities. And while women may joke about the fact that men are obsessed about the size of their penis, women are obsessed about other things. So we all struggle with these insecurities. So
She wasn't specific about what she wanted to change.
She didn't say in what way. Yes, that is correct. So it could have been a reduction. Yes.
We're going to put the following picture of Steve Harvey with his aghast face.
Yes, based on that event, we don't know how he could have responded to that other question. But we do see here that he has powerful legs. And as a whole, he's like Lebanon, which is known for its beautiful mountains and trees. She longs to kiss his mouth and to taste him. The crowd asks where he's gone so that they may help her find him. He is worth finding. They also affirm her as the most beautiful of women. And so, see, I got one more section done. The allegorical interpretation would be that this is a song of praise for Jesus. With his six-pack abs. of course, we know little about what Jesus looked like, except he was Middle Eastern and a man. Isaiah indicated that there was nothing that would draw us to him. So there you have that. His eyes were pure. He is steadfast. He speaks beautifully. Beautiful, gracious words is kind of how they take that. Dramatic. She sings the praises of her husband. He is handsome and speaks grace-filled words. She likes his looks and she likes his character. Okay? So, we'll end here with the Steve Harvey joke. So, any questions? None. Okay. We actually only have a little bit left in this lesson, and we'll I think we'll finish next lesson too next week. She's a beauty. So why don't we pray? Father, there's a lot here that indicates it's a lot of reality, even amidst all of these confusing metaphors and similes of we all struggle in intimate relationships, and that they're not always what we want them to be. And Father, we all struggle with what we do with that. Whether we operate with one another on the basis of law or grace. Whether we pursue one another or whether we, so to speak, stay in bed and aren't bothered. And Father, as well, we see here that there's also a desire to be seen as desirable, at least by one person. And so, but yeah, work in the relationships that are represented in this room, in this congregation, that we might grow in grace and how we treat each other, and that we would be focused more on the other as opposed to ourselves. Grant us the grace of self-forgetfulness instead of the curse of self-obsession. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.